rewarding members, giving them encouragement, being nice, that's all part of it. What's the better than selling principle? Better than soliciting, better than selling. What does it involve? Short term, long term? Long term. So what does it mean in terms of better than selling means instead of making a sale, make a customer. So better than soliciting means in practical terms, what does it mean? Make a devotee or a member. Make someone a devotee, make him a member. In other words, someone who will come back to you again and again. Who's the greatest member you'll ever make? Yourself, right. Why is that? Who can say? Because of conviction, right. So what will conviction do for others? Yes. Yes. What did we say about logic and emotion? Yes. Emotion is more important. Yes, the ocean of emotion. So, where do people buy from? They buy from the heart. They buy from emotion. People are ruled by their emotions. What are the only two things that people ever donate for? Very specifically, I wrote these things out on the board. It was very clear. Good feelings and solutions to problems. So in selling or in preaching, we have to keep this in mind. Yes. They'll donate much more when they donate to whom? No. It's all right. I'll try it. Why is it that they'll donate much more when they donate to you? Huh? Because you make them feel good and you solve their problems, right? Okay. Stop that now. All right, anyway, I'll get on with it because, again, we don't have much time this afternoon. The topic this afternoon is managing the moments of truth, 10 action-ready strategies. Does everybody know what the moments of truth are? Bhagavatam class, Bhagavad Gita class. And what are the moments of truth in preaching or in selling? Conclusion? That's not what I was thinking of, but yet any contact. Contact with the customer, with the member, with the prospect. When someone from ISKCON, when a devotee comes in contact with another person for the purpose of preaching, that's known as a moment of truth. It's a term used in business a lot. For example, what is an example of a major airline in Europe that turned around from a $50 million loser to a $75 million profit maker within 8 months? Huh? Yes, Scandinavian Airlines, SAS. S-A-S. So the chairman, or the president, pardon me, of Scandinavian Airlines, his name was Jan Carlson. So he calculated that one company, they had approximately, he calculated they had about 10 million passengers a year. And he calculated that every passenger, he did a study, every passenger on an average came in contact with 5 employees of the company. So they were losing money. They were losing $50 million a year. going in the red. That's not good. That's very bad for a company. And he calculated that they had, on an average, 5 times 10 or 50 million moments of truth where there was an opportunity for the employees of the company to render service to their customers. Because if you ask any of the companies in America, they have what they call the Fortune 500 companies, the top. There's a magazine called Fortune Magazine, and they have a list of the top companies in America. So there's 500 that are on their list. So it's a famous list. It's very prestigious to be one of the Fortune 500. So there were surveys done of the Fortune 500 companies, and practically it was unanimous amongst all the chairmen, CEOs, presidents, that the number one strategy or the number one important thing for developing and increasing their business was to what? To do what? To take care of the customer. To develop a service attitude for the customer. That's the number one priority in practically every company. So Mr. Carlson, he figured out that there were 50 million moments of truth. And what he did was, his strategy for turning SAS around in only 8 months, I mean, that's a short time to turn a company around. But he was determined to do it. He was a person who gets things done. So he put all of the employees into a training program. And he made it mandatory. I mean, it wasn't just you could come if you wanted to, but on company time, okay? On company time, he put all of the employees into a training program to teach them how to manage the moments of truth and how to focus on the customers and how to give them more for their value, how to make them feel glad to be on a Scandinavian Airlines plane. And that strategy paid off very, very well. So I know that a lot of the things that I'm talking about today and we have been talking about in the communications ministry, a lot of the things that Mukunda Maharaj is going to talk to you about tomorrow, a lot of the things that Naveen Krishna is going to talk to you about, systems, administration, management, managing your time. Most of us are accustomed, at least I have to speak for myself, Atma Van Manyate Jagat. But I think it's a fact with a lot of us that we're accustomed, we've never been trained properly. How many of you have actually, in your secular life or in ISKCON life, how many of you have gone through a very regular training program to, say, learn how to cook, or to learn how to manage, or to learn how to do anything, literally? How many have gone through a program? A few of you have, but not many. I know I never learned any. The first thing I learned was how to carry a book bag. And, you know, how to distribute mantra cards and how to... I didn't even get... You know, the training for learning how to play a mridanga was hit it. You know, that was the training. Of course, Prabhupada said, but he actually would have... Because Prabhupada himself underwent a training program to learn how to play mridanga. Every day he would be taught by his father and by other musicians. So, it is possible. We think it's impossible, but it is possible if we want it bad enough. And this is the key. What we really want from our society. Where we want to go, where we want to take our mission, what we want to be to the world today and tomorrow. If we want it bad enough, it is possible to get ourselves organized and trained and become efficient and answer the phone and do all those wonderful things that are so difficult to conceive of now, but are things that are done by any successful nonprofit organization, religious organization, or even in the business world, any successful business, of course. We don't want to compare ourselves with a business, but as we were explaining this morning, Rupa Goswami's philosophy is Yukta Vairagya. That's the wonderful thing about the philosophy that Prabhupada's given us, is that we can use these things in Krishna's service. So I just, if I can do anything today, I'm giving some examples and some facts and recommending some books, but if I can do anything today, I'll feel myself very, very satisfied if I can just inspire or encourage a few of you who have probably already got the idea that now is the time for us to get our act together in ISKCON, because we have a very big role to play in saving the world from the hellish condition into which they're heading. And that responsibility lies on our heads, and the only way we can achieve it, it's an impossible task, but the only way we can achieve it is if we discipline ourselves like yogis. We are yogis. We're meant to control our minds. We're meant to control our senses and engage them in the service of Krishna. And I'm convinced, I'm 100% convinced, that it is possible that we can train ourselves to be very efficient, effective, and expert, excellence. So this video that I'm going to show you just now, some of you may think it's a little bit Mickey Mouse. I think you have Disneyland in Europe now, huh? In Paris or something? How many have been there now? Be honest. Not many of you. Oh, he has. Okay, that's all right. He's from Paris, so it's okay. Some of you may think this video is a little bit Mickey Mouse, that it has nothing to do with us, but it really does. I wouldn't be wasting your time. Mukunda Maharaj has shown it around the world. I've also shown it. I showed it to the GBC body this year. They were very, apart from the fun part of it, it was the best part of the meetings, Naveen said. But it has, I'm very serious, it has application for us. It has meaning for us. So please meditate while you're watching it. I won't bore you with the whole thing. And please excuse the fact that in it you'll see something about the regulative principles being broken. Reject that part of it, but understand the principle that we can do it if we start now, be disciplined, systematic, be yogis, be devotees. We can do it. So, let's see here. Where's the volume? The volume
thing, and the American consuming public would have bought it starting in 1946, and that's roughly what happened. It didn't take a whole lot of genius to run a company. And during this whole time period, we built all these management techniques and devices and complex structures and made the horrible mistake of associating the structures with the success, when the success, frankly, was a bit of an anomaly from the environment.
A few of us began to think, I guess increasingly strongly, that we were in nothing less than crisis, because industry after industry we were starting to lose to foreign competition. I mean, things we used to own, like the automobile industry, suddenly was somebody else's, the Germans and the Japanese. And we felt very strongly that unless, something different happened, and I mean greatly different, not the same old stuff again, and not a reinforcement of the same old management technique, unless something really different happened, we were really headed downhill fast as an economy. And so we went out looking for models of, is somebody doing it right? And are they doing it right in the United States?
Looked at another way, it's nothing less than a 180-degree shift in the way we think about managing and leading. The models and the metaphors of the past have been the manager as a cop, as a referee, as a devil's advocate, as a naysayer, as a pronouncer. The words that we found that seem much more appropriate in the excellent companies are the manager, the leader, as a cheerleader, as a coach, as a facilitator, as a nurturer of champions. It's a sadly missing, but it all comes from the people.
Ladies and gentlemen, birthday parade!
If you're looking for excellence in American business, this parade is a good place to start. The best-loved characters ever created are strutting their stuff down Main Street at Walt Disney World, and people are having the time of their lives. Disney Productions theme parks are designed and managed with only one thing in mind: satisfying the customer. When it comes to providing an entertainment vacation land for the whole family, Disney has no peer. Florida, the gates to Walt Disney World open at 9 a.m. every day of the year. In less than an hour, the grounds are mobbed. On a busy summer day, more than 100,000 people will converge on the park. The price of a one-day ticket to the Magic Kingdom or Epcot Center is $18. But most folks buy a 3 or 4 day pass, stay on the property at one of 3 Disney-owned hotels, and eat their meals in Disney restaurants. Last year, the park hosted 23 million people from all over the world and took in gross receipts of $730 million. What is it that attracts people in these numbers? In a word, the irresistible magic of Disney make-believe. Mickey Mouse, the park trademark, is the emblem of that magic. When a Disney executive takes you out to lunch and tells you it's on the mouse, he's not kidding. But how is it possible to sustain a seamless world of make-believe in the midst of this teeming crowd? The Disney solution to this challenge is one of the best examples in American business of how a large company communicates its values to its employees. The world of make-believe isn't real. It's a continuous performance occurring all around you. The physical park is a giant stage. But to come alive, a stage needs performers. What Disney does better than anyone else in the business is train its employees to be performers in a live show.
Come on, raise them real high, repeat after me. I hope we never return. Okay, we'll be in good shape. As we leave civilization behind, we enter the mighty Amazon River of South America. Oh, look at this. We're moving into a pool of dangerous hippopotami. They can easily upset our boats. Now watch out for these guys. They are dangerous. They've been sinking our boats all week long. There's a charger on the left, and another one's on the right, guys. Oh, hey, crew. Shh. We're in headhunter territory now. Yeah.
Every smallest detail of the company's elaborate training program is designed to create an awareness in its employees that Walt Disney World is, above all, show business.
Bye, Chris. Bye. 10 minutes in the jungle, and you forget your manners.
There is no personnel office here. You are hired at Central Casting, and on day one as a new hire, everyone is required to take Traditions 1 at Walt Disney University.
Does anybody know all 7 dwarfs? Anybody got all 7 dwarfs? Go ahead.
Not sleepy, grumpy, dopey, sleepy, happy, and droopy.
Nope. You got 6 out of 7. What's the 7th one? Bashful. That's right. There's no Godzilla.
The day begins with apparently trivial pursuits, but there is method here. As the trainer drills his class about Mickey and Snow White and Fantasia, he enfolds them in Walt Disney's vision of the Magic Kingdom. He creates the illusion that Walt himself is present, welcoming the new hires to his personal domain. The object is to make these new employees feel like partners with the park's founder, sharing a mission to create the most wonderful place in the world.
And if you went to Tomorrowland, you could...
There is no better example of how a large company instills values in its employees.
And of course, he made sure he kept the place clean. He made sure it was simple and unconfusing. He made sure that he gave the people a good value for the dollar that they spent when they visited Disneyland. And most of all, he made sure that all of his employees were friendly, polite, courteous, and helpful. Just grab a seat, make yourself comfortable.
After lunch, the class moves to a small theater, the perfect setting in which to learn that they are all to be players in a live performance.
What business are we in? You know, everybody knows that McDonald's makes hamburgers, General Motors makes automobiles, Sony makes TVs, but what does Disney make? Makes people happy. Exactly. Doesn't matter who they are, where they come from, what they do, what language they speak, what color they are, or anything else. We're here to make them happy. Nobody's been hired for a job. Everybody has been cast for a role in our show. Because of that, everyone's a cast member. You're all hosts and hostesses. There's no custodians, no cops, and there's no bellboys or anything else. Everybody's a host and a hostess. We also work on stage. We take a break, we go backstage. We wear a costume, not a uniform. Of course, we deal with an audience. Not a crowd. That audience is made up of guests and of visitors, not of tourists. It reminds us what business we're in. We are in show business. We are in entertainment.
On stage, off stage. A simple distinction that Disney drums into its employees endlessly. Walt Disney saw to it that the stage itself, what customers see as they move through the park, was what he called picture perfect. There are props, backdrops, lights, and everything.
At the Riviera.
He made certain that nothing was allowed to mar the picture.
17 years after his death, custodial crews sweep and polish the park around the clock.
It's really understage. The park is elevated. At ground level, beneath it, runs a maze of tunnels called the Underpark. Located down here is the computer center which controls the rides, a cafeteria for employees, and the wardrobe department. Clean costumes, not uniforms, are issued to cast members, not employees, at the beginning of each day. With 2 million items in stock, this is the largest theatrical wardrobe in the world.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
In the Underpark, strictly off limits to customers, employees may smoke, eat and drink, fix their makeup, and in general behave as they do in the real world. But once they ascend from the tunnel and enter the Magic Kingdom through inconspicuous doors in quiet corners, they are on stage again and expected to perform. It's easy to see that masked and costumed characters like Captain Hook are performing. But the thing to remember, and the point that Disney emphasizes to its employees, is that everyone is a part of the show, including the VIP hostesses stationed near City Hall to answer questions.
When you get to each land, it's going to be a little more detailed, and it'll list all the attractions, restaurants, and shops.
Okay?
So you shouldn't miss a thing, and you're starting off in Town Square, okay? How are you today?
Good.
Each player's responsibility is the same. Make the guests, not customers, feel welcome and special.
This guy is important. How can I make him feel that way? What can I do to give him the kind of day that he came to Walt Disney World for? And that's not easy. I'm not going to kid you. That's probably the most difficult thing you're going to have to contend with here at Walt Disney World. People get upset. They get angry. They get lost. They get confused. They get hot. And they take it out on you. And you don't deserve it. How do you do it? How do you maintain friendly, smiling, polite people? You know, we get letters every day, all the time.
Like everything else in the park, the training itself is a performance, scripted, rehearsed, and faultlessly delivered by the trainer.
And I'm going to stand here and I'm going to throw pixie dust over you all your other folks. It doesn't work that way.
How does Disney do it? By making certain everyone understands his role in the show. When Traditions 1 has been completed, New hires go into the park for 3 days of operations training. Disney chooses terminology for the image it projects. Rides aren't rides, they're attractions. And the script, in a hats off to the carnival barker, is called the spiel. That's not spiel, but spiel. At the Jungle Boat Cruise, the spiel is 9 pages long. To discourage ad-libbing, it includes a list of approved variations and 3 pages on the philosophy of the ride. Nothing is left to chance.
If you can, try to act like you're steering, okay?
Hard to remember. And it looks like we've stumbled into the sacred bathing pool of the elephants. Whole herds of playful Indian elephants migrate here every day.
Okay, look out ahead. He's coming up. Oh, yeah. Oh, he's turned on the left. Look out ahead. He's coming up. Oh, yeah. Oh, he's turned on the left. Yeah, okay. Oh, he's turned on the left. Yeah, okay. All right, all right, all right. You better look out. Turn around as much as you can until lean in, lean in, lean in. Okay. Okay, make it look as dramatic as you can. You got to make it look like they're going to get wet. Okay. Lean in, lean in. You're scared as they are. Okay. You're just driving the boat. You're trying. You want them to lean in as much as they can because that water's going to come right at them. Okay.
From working with my trainer, he showed me a lot about different things you can do to line them up, to get their mind off of it. When they start out on the jungle cruise, they're going into the jungle. They're no longer anywhere except for the jungle. And it's my job to take them away and put them there.
When is the show supposed to start? What is the show going to be about?
Well, it's a Donald Duck parade, and what it is it's a tribute to Donald Duck because it is his 50th birthday.
But it isn't only the obvious performers who are trained. To make a customer feel special as you point the way to Fantasyland or the nearest restroom requires its own kind of training.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. The minute you walk through City Hall and you're out here on Main Street, then we're on stage. You need to be all smiles. That's what the guests remember. They remember what that person said to them, what that cast member told them when they were in front of City Hall, and that you were smiling or that you took extra time with them. Those are the important things.
Okay, I'm in the process of making your rounds.
Everyone is taught a role. Sweeping up the park seems a simple task, but Disney knows that these custodial crews will receive more questions from customers than anyone else in the cast.
At the same time, you have to be courteous, you know, and to be aware of the guests around you and their questions. And even though you get the same question asked 3 or 4 times, you know, you gotta remember each time there's a different guest asking it.
Those trained longest and hardest are the Disney characters. And watching them learn the steps and gestures that make each one of them unique is a real treat. But this part of the training we are not allowed to show. Disney knows that these creatures are the wellspring of the enchantment which is its stock in trade, and protects them fiercely. The most strictly enforced rule in the park is that no one outside the cast shall ever be permitted to see a character with its mask off. The illusion must be maintained. These players are taught never, under any circumstances, to break character. We tried to peek behind the mask by filming Goofy in the underpark before he went on stage. But even down here, because we were there with our cameras, Goofy played Goofy. The key to Disney's success is its commitment to making sure that people who come here have a good time, and the training program the company has developed to achieve that end. Disney will go to any lengths to make certain that every one of its 19,000 employees understands its credo and the importance of his or her role in the show to creating the world of make-believe. The payoff is plain to see. The Magic Kingdom truly becomes a magical place. Try resisting Disco Donald. It isn't easy. Crowds flock here as if lured by the Pied Piper. And once inside these walls, no less than the children of Hamelin, they are enthralled. This isn't Walt Disney World. It's a family-owned food store in Norwalk, Connecticut, Stu Leonard's Dairy. But Stu Leonard, in his own way, knows every bit as well as Disney how to make his customers feel special. He achieves that by listening to them. This phenomenally successful family business is a delicious example of how a simple thing like listening to the customer can pay off.
I'm from Cleveland, and I've never seen anything like this in all my life.
What is so different? What is it that you like?
It's just fabulous. It's different. There's just nothing like it.
And it's the only grocery my husband will come to.
Is that right?
And Mocha Stella's greatest smoke ever. I think.
An average supermarket with 16,000 items on its shelves may do $200,000 of business in a good week. Stu Leonard's grosses $1.5 million a week with only 750 items. An astonishing $80 million a year. Part of the attraction are the prices. Stu buys directly from the producer by the trailer truckload. Meat from Iowa, fruit and produce from California. Milk is processed right in the store, originally a small dairy opened by Stu's father in 1921.
Why don't you put a bulk over here so there's an aisle for the customer, right?
Stu Leonard is out on the floor every day, working the crowd like a politician on the campaign trail. Like all successful businessmen, his work is his passion. He can't keep his hands off the merchandise or the customers. Stu styles himself a monomaniac with a mission, and he is crystal clear about what his mission is, to make every customer that enters his store feel special.
What we did here is we went around on the customer side of the table, and we said, what exactly do they want? They want better stuff at a lower price. They want a fun atmosphere. Most people think that food shopping is a drudgery. They dread it. When we did that, and when we started to really get our ear to the ground and listen to the customers and keep giving them what they wanted, before I knew it, I had to put an addition on. And then another. We put on 24 additions. And it's nothing more than listening to the customer and doing what they say.
Stu Leonard Jr. has been working in the store since he was a boy and shares his father's love for the business. 30 years old, with an MBA from the University of California, Stu Jr. is in charge of company finance and the overseer of customer relations, the number one priority here.
If you work for it.
Every other Saturday afternoon, Stu Jr. leads a focus group with customers who volunteer their time to let management know what they like and don't like about the store.
When I first started to come here, you carried your own brand of ice cream in plastic tubs that I could take home.
It's hard to imagine customers caring enough to take the time. But if they didn't care, they wouldn't be here.
They were like this, they were round, they could let on them.
Plastic containers. Sure, yes, sure. I use them in my freezer.
Would you buy the round plastic tub if it was...
Stu's younger brother Tom is in charge of produce. The whole family, including Stu's two younger sisters and a number of uncles and aunts, are involved in the business.
I would prefer it in the plastic. It's much neater and it doesn't drip in my
cup. Would everybody like that?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
The family's access to customer opinion on a daily basis is this oversized suggestion box.
Our customers tell us what they don't like.
Traditional wisdom has it that suggestion boxes are useless because people are conditioned to expect that no one cares about their two cents. This one is stuffed to capacity every business day.
Somebody takes these out of here first job in the morning. The first thing they do, come and open this up, and by 11 a.m. every morning we have them typed up and there's 30 copies of them. Distributed throughout the dairy. You know, here's one, how about stocking jars of baby food, a customer wrote in. I mean, that's a good idea, we'll look into it. There's another person wrote the tuna salad. They say it's more like tuna soup, so we changed that. We're adding less mayonnaise to it. Everything is okay, I'm from Tennessee and love it. You know, but we get all these. Here's one that someone wrote, I bought a bag of jelly donuts, the raspberry jelly was fine, but the dough of the donuts was awful. It wasn't moist. So, I mean, we talked to the donut guy this morning when he came in about that.
But the concept is that only happy customers come back. We don't go back to restaurants that we don't like, and we don't go back to food stores. You know, that's the basic thing. And how do we know what they don't like? They tell us. The reason they tell us is how we react to it.
1 month, we had a meeting, and we sat around, and we said, okay, let's tell us what you don't like about our store. And one of the ladies stood up, and she said, I'll tell you what I don't like. She said, I don't like your fish. And we said, what do you mean you don't like your fish? She said, well, it's not fresh. She said, I like to go to a fish market and buy fresh fish. So the fish guy who was there, Nick, stood up and he said, what do you mean it's not? He said, we get that fresh every morning from Fulton Fish Market. He said, we get that fresh from the Boston Piers every morning. He said, I guarantee that's fresh. And the person said, what do you mean? She said, it's packaged. She said, this is a supermarket package. And now here's some bluefish that's packaged. And so what we did was we set up a fish bar with ice on it. And we took and built this right after that training. And now here's a bluefish for the same price right over here, but some people like to buy it fresh right off the ice, and with the service and everything, so it's the same price as over in the package. Our packaged fish didn't decrease at all, but we doubled our fish sales. We were doing about 15,000 pounds a week, now we're doing 30,000 pounds a week.
Well, we used to sell the strawberries like everybody else in little quart baskets. And a customer suggested that we let her pick them out of the big tray as we brought them out. And we tried it. And we put the display out with all the strawberries just out of the box from the farmer. And you can't believe what's happening down there. The sales went up like triple. And now, you know, people are buying more than they even think. For example, look at that. Well, look at that woman in the yellow down there. She's going to get to the register and find she's got about a $9 bag of strawberries there. But they're thrilled and they're happy, you know, that they're getting what they want. And it's back to the old store to give the customer what they want. Nobody walks in the door and says, what can I do for Stu Leonard today? I mean, they walk in here and say, what can he do for me? And if he doesn't do it, I'm not going to come back. And I don't blame him. And why should they?
What does Stu Leonard's Dairy have in common with the 3M Company of St. Paul, Minnesota? An extraordinary responsiveness to the customer. 3M develops hundreds of new products every year, 90% of them in direct response to customer needs. But how does a multi-billion dollar corporation with over 40 divisions maintain this level of product innovation? If 3M is any indication, by creating a climate expressly designed to nourish its innovators, the product champions. Every one of 3M's 6,000 scientists worldwide is expected to steal 15% of his time away from authorized projects for use in developing new technologies, a practice the company refers to as bootlegging. Money, equipment, and personnel may also be appropriated from projects underway without going through proper channels. This variety of lawlessness is institutionalized. Everyone looks the other way. Louis Lair, Chairman of the Board and Chief Executive Officer, founder of 3M's Medical Products Division, was a product champion and bootlegger par excellence in his own day.
When we have a technology that doesn't have a defined need, there has to be someone within the organization who fights the battle of finding a need for the product, of supporting it, of believing in it. And if they believe in it, nine times out of ten, we are successful in commercializing that technology into one or perhaps many more products.
The story of the sticky yellow notes called Post-it is a prime example of how innovation happens at 3M. No matter how many years it takes or how many dead ends are encountered along the way, a new product idea is not abandoned.
It all started in church. I was singing in a choir at North Church. And we would sing for two different services. And I would mark the pages with little pieces of paper, normally. And sometimes they would fall out in between services. The first service, the second service, I'd get up, there'd be a big scramble. I thought, what I really need is something that's going to, a bookmark that's going to stick to those pages, to the right spot, and still not damage the book when I pull them off. And it will mark the right spot on the in the book. And I knew that the spent silver back in our laboratory had just developed an adhesive that would do that. And I made samples. They were rough samples of the bookmarks and took them back and tried them out at church. Now they were small size, but when I was making them up, I'd also made up some larger size and found, hey, these are really handy for notes.
This material that we had made with these new monomers, it had very peculiar properties in that it did not meet any of the criteria we had set as goals for a program, which were, for example, very high shear adhesion, very high peel adhesion, and very aggressively tacky material. It was, in fact, a very poor adhesive in all respects. It failed all the peel tests. It failed the shear tests. It failed a lot of the other conventional 3M adhesive tests that one employs. So rather than throw it away, we decided to investigate some of its properties because it was rather unique.
The main problem is attaching notes temporarily and yet permanently temporary. This product is permanently temporary. You know, 30 years from now, you can take that note off, even though you put it in a stack of books, and it will come off.
and not damage your product. Now, it took a lot of very careful design to do this.
Here, let me show you. Just a bar graph here. And this is adhesion, or tackiness, how tightly something sticks. Okay, this would represent, say, a packaging tape. Okay, this might represent magic tape, the kind that you use in your office and your desk and on papers. Now, this represents the force required to pull paper apart. If we stick packaging tape or magic tape on paper, rip it off, it's going to pull it apart. So we had to fit a range like that. And this is for Post-it. If it's too low, it falls off. If it's too high, it pulls it apart. So this is it's a product that is very easy to use, but very tricky to make.
But there's got to be a believer who will put his career on the line, who will, as a matter of fact, bootleg a little bit of time so that he can work on the product and the program. Post-it notes was a prime example. It was an adhesive which didn't stick. And the whole history of 3M has been to develop adhesives that stick better.
This office product, of course, really didn't get the excitement of our marketing department. So we in the laboratory, we knew that we had to get that excitement. So the way to do that was to hook them. And the way we did that was to sample those people throughout the company, but particularly on the 13th and 14th floor.
And I looked at it, and as far as I was concerned, it was just a piece of yellow paper with some adhesive on the back, and I thought, well, leave some with me, Jeff, and I'll see what I think of them. And I just threw them on the desk, and I found that I started to use them, stick them on a piece of paper, scroll a note to someone on them, and they were just plain handy. And eventually, I found they were real addictive.
And it wasn't long before my secretary was getting all kinds of phone calls requesting further and more samples.
Well, it mushroomed. They all wanted them. They wanted more. They answered back. They called. Please send more. It was a problem. I didn't have enough supply to respond to all these people, and I was caught right in the middle. Short on supply, too many customers, trying to please everyone. And it was at that point that I went to Jeff and said, I can no longer handle this. There's too many requests, and I don't have enough supply. And all I'm doing is sending out Post-it notes. I'm not getting my work done.
I said, that's it. From now on, stop all shipment of this product to the rest of the company. Redirect all those telephone calls to the marketing department. We're going to get their interest. And we did.
So we developed the idea that if we could get this simple little product used in the offices of the CEOs of the major Fortune 500 companies, hopefully they would become as addicted as we in 3M had. Program was developed whereby my secretary sent samples to the executive secretaries of the top, I think, 500 CEOs in the country. She got a very nice response because there was an explanation of how they should be used. Then at meetings I attended, I began to hear from some of my peer CEOs, what's this little yellow product you've got in my office? I keep hearing my secretary talk about it. She's sending me notes. And now I'm beginning to hear from our purchasing agents, the people within the organization want the product.
I knew in my bones, as soon as I'd gotten hooked on it, that that was going to deliver 3M margins. It's that kind of product. It was unique enough and special enough. And if you go out and be the firstest with the mostest, you're going to get there on something like that. And the proof is, it does deliver margins.
People comment to me more about Post-it notes than any other product we make. And they tell me what I like to hear, which is that they are addictive.
And addictive they are, to the tune of an estimated $200 million a year in sales. Post-it illustrates how tenaciously 3M seeks a product application for a new technology. And it exemplifies something else, the continuity within the diversity of 3M's product line. Like Post-it, the company originated with a mistake. In 1902, five Minnesota entrepreneurs bought a corundum mine.
Anyway, there's a lot more to the video about leadership and about training and etc. I think all of you get the message. As I said, we can also do it if we want to. Can someone help me? I've got to take this down and put up the again this overhead projector. So we're going to talk, as I think you've seen the schedule, about managing the moments of truth. And 10 action-ready steps, or strategies rather. The beginning is what to do when the member appears, calls, or inquires. Basically, as I told you, that's considered a moment of truth. When we come in contact with a member. And keep in mind, again, like I said this morning, a member means a congregational member, a life member, someone just visiting the temple for the first time. These are all in that category. I'm just using that word, member. So the point is, first impression. Someone said that you never get a second chance to make a good first impression. So it's very important, and especially in our work, especially because we want to change the more or less bad reputation that we have. So it is literally important for us to put a little money. We spend so much money in going out and selling our books. We're in the business of selling so many things. So it is important for us. It is important for us to prepare and plan for dealing with people. So 10 kind of things that we can do, action steps. One is acknowledge people. As we said, what 68% of people leave a company because someone was what? Rude or indifferent, ignored them. So the first thing we need to train our devotees to do is acknowledge guests, members, or whatever when they come. Don't ignore them. That's the worst thing you can do. And I think the fact is, I've seen many, many temples around the world. Being a sannyasi, you know, we gather no moss and all that kind of jazz. So we do a lot of traveling. And I've traveled around the world and been to most of our temples in ISKCON, except for South America. I've never been there. But in practically in every other area, now CIS, I have to admit. Anyway, I'll try to take that up in the fall. But anyway, most of the temples that I've been to, I've been underwhelmed at the level of reception that we have. I've seen guests come in, especially on Sunday or whatever, and there's no one there to even, you know, say hello and greet them and find out who they are, ask if it's their first time and if they have any questions or anything. It's kind of like we put on a show, but, you know, that's it. We've done our responsibility. When it comes time to the Sunday feast, the brahmacharis are over in one corner taking the feast. The ladies are maybe in the back and, or whatever, anywhere. And the guests are being served, but it's very rare to find, you know, the devotees like it used to be. As I said, the success syndrome. In the beginning, when we started ISKCON, devotees were very receptive to be with the guests. There's a World of Hare Krishna video. Maybe you've seen that World. How many have seen that World of Hare Krishna video? Now, you've seen that one that's present now. How many have seen the one before it, the version before it? Okay, part of that, there's a scene of the Sunday feast in Boston. You remember that? Yeah, it's got a picture of the, a portion of it, a couple of seconds of the Sunday feast in Boston Temple, the old Boston Temple. And you see lines of guests, and right in front of them, there are lines of devotees. There's one devotee practically talking to every two, three guests. So that's what we literally did. We spent a lot of time with the people who came to our temples, and we made devotees by it. Now, I know here in Europe, Hare Kesha Maharaj has a prayer in his zone that, my dear Lord, you know, Sri Sri Radha Krishna, Radha Gopinath, Radha, so many things, but in every temple, please send us more devotees so that we can increase your book distribution. There's a prayer and a consciousness and an emphasis on that. So all I'm saying is that this is one step that we need to take to help us to focus on the members when they appear, call, or inquire. And that includes on the telephone also. Telephone is a very, very powerful instrument. It's the next best thing to actually meeting someone, is calling them on the telephone. So we have to make sure that we don't ignore our telephone reception. How many temples that you know of have full-time, at least 8 hours a day receptionists, so that when somebody answers, they get a response? Those 4, 5, maybe 6. Huh? They get fried? Oh, you're trying. It's very, very important. And I think I told this joke in Germany. It's not a joke in Germany, but the FBI and the government were doing an investigation on dangerous cults. And in America, dangerous cults. And they were talking about different groups, and somehow or other, this was years ago, but Hare Krishna came up, and the FBI man got up in front of the government-appointed people and said that we don't have to worry about Hare Krishna because they can't even answer the telephone properly. So that's not something to be proud of, really. So telephone is very important. We need to focus on giving prompt attention, no delay. In other words, when people come to us with problems, like for example in fundraising, one of the most important aspects of fundraising is thanking people for their donation. It's a sin. It's one of the 7 sins of fundraising, not to thank people for their donation. So it's sad that within 48 hours, there should be a letter in the mail, no later than 48 hours. So before you do fundraising, say mail fundraising, direct mail, you should have a program set up whereby you can generate fundraising letters, thank you letters, that within 48 hours, people are going to get a thank you. So it's very, very important. Prompt attention for anything. If someone comes to the temple, phones or mails a letter, whatever it is, that's a moment of truth. And we should deal with it very promptly and immediately. Be prepared for, questions. That's a question mark there. Be prepared for questions. In other words, part of your preparation is to anticipate the kinds of questions that people will ask when they come to the temple. And you should have pamphlets, you should have brochures, you should have so many things readily accessible, available, that you can give to people when they come to the temple. It's one of the things, like you saw in the Walt Disney video, they think of everything beforehand, and they train their people. They invest money in doing it, and it pays off. It gives dividends. If we can't, if we look foolish if someone comes to our temple and asks a question which we can't help them with or can't answer, then we look very foolish. Of course, we try to answer everything, but when you're nicely prepared, you give them a brochure, you give them a magazine that deals specifically with their question, you give them a nice answer yourself, whatever it is, that's a solid first impression. They're impressed with you. The opposite, if you don't give them a good impression, then again, they'll go, they probably won't come back, and they'll tell others that we don't know what we're doing. For example, one of the best organizations, they're very well managed, but one thing that I've experienced, the Mormons, they have a big problem with their philosophy. You know, that everybody goes back to Godhead, the whole family. And, you know, you go back with your daughter and your sister and your wife and, you know, they've got some big problems with that theory, and they, you know, they just act totally bewildered when you ask them, well, you know, what age do I go back? Can I go at 35 or 45? What does my wife go back at, you know, which age? And does my grandmother have to remain my grandmother? Or, you know, they've got some real problems. So we should know the answers to questions. I remember once there was a story about Billy Graham. Have you heard of Billy Graham, the preacher? So he was in a small town in America. He was some program he was doing. And he wanted to, he was out looking for the post office to mail a letter. So he saw a young boy and he asked him, do you know where the post office is? I can't find the post office. So the boy told him the right way to go. He asked him, what's the way to the post office? And the boy told him. So then he turned around and said that I'm giving a program, a speech, a sermon tonight. Why don't you come, young man, and I'll tell you the way to get to heaven. And the young boy said, I don't know, I don't think I'll come. I don't know how you're going to tell people the way to get to heaven. You don't even know the way to the post office. So the point is we should know the answers to people's questions.